All right, welcome back. 239-1310. 239-1310 this afternoon. His name is Terry Curry. He is the prosecutor of Marion County, and he has been busy. We'll tell you some of the things he's been busy about, particularly getting ready for next Tuesday, July 1st, when some of the rules of the game changes. And I'm dreading trying to figure out we're not going to A level, B level, level one, level two felonies, all this kind of stuff. Anyway, prosecutor, welcome. Always good to see you.
Thank you, Amos. Thanks for having us.
So what is this thing where people were working on a project that was funded by our tax dollars, and they're supposed to be paid certain living wages, and they were cheated out of those wages? What's going on?
In Indiana, used to be called prevailing wage. Now actually statute is called common wage statute. Mm-hmm. And in a nutshell, what it provides is that in any public construction project, the wages of the employees are set by a common wage committee.
Right.
And so it's broken down by classification. Number one, is it a carpenter, a laborer, plumber, pipe fitter sort of thing? And then secondly, there's three tiers based on level of experience. And in the classification is called unskilled, semi-skilled, and skilled.
Right.
And you know, obviously the point of that is to make sure that if we're spending tax dollars on public construction projects, that we're going to have competent people with appropriate experience who are doing any given project, you know, whether that's Eskenazi Hospital or an IPS project. And in the course of our campaign in 2010, it became apparent that there was a widespread belief that individuals were cheating on that requirement. It can be enforced in three ways. The Indiana Department of Labor has the ability to oversee it and enforce it, but the Indiana Department of Labor has one auditor for the entire state of Indiana. Mm-hmm. An employee who learns of it could sue, but obviously employees are not going to do that if it means they're going to lose their job. And the third way is it's actually a crime. It's a Class B misdemeanor to not pay the wage. And so we made it a priority. We prosecuted the first ever case in 2011 against a company called White River Mechanical. And obviously, as you're aware, we resolved two more of those cases this week. And the significance is not only as it impacts the employees who are not being paid what they're entitled to. In one of the cases this week, the common wage requirement would have required the employees to be paid $39 an hour, combined wages and benefits. Mm-hmm. And instead, they were being paid about $12 an hour. So, number one, obviously, the employees being deprived of the compensation that they're entitled to. But just as importantly, the big problem is that it undermines the bidding process, and that those contractors who play by the rules can't effectively bid against a subcontractor contractor who goes in knowing they're not going to pay that wage and can significantly underbid other contractors.
Was this also a failure of oversight by the people doing the project? Don't they have the responsibility to spot check the records of the contractor, subcontractor, if they're on a common wage project, to spot check whether people are being paid what they're supposed to be paid? Is this part of this investigation show a breakdown of oversight?
Well, yes and no, in that you're exactly right that the contractor, the general contractor, our construction manager would have a requirement. Certainly, that's all built into the bid documents and the ultimate contracts, those requirements. But in one of the cases we prosecuted, actually, the failure of one of the subs to pay was actually brought to light in part by the general contractor. So in that particular situation, the general did what was required of them.
If there were these problems that you uncovered, should we be worried that there are other problems? And is part of this, maybe some of these employees were afraid to complain either because they didn't know how to complain or perhaps they were afraid of retaliation?
Yeah, clearly, and we've looked at a couple other situations that have not resulted in charges, and in part, it's because employees came to us and truly got cold feet, just as you've suggested, because it was more important to them to keep their job and to have employment. What we've tried to stress is we've talked to the building trades, as we've talked to contractors, subcontractors, is if you believe that this is going on, come to us. And even if an employee cooperates with us, you know, we can take steps in the investigation process where we can establish what we need to establish without ever outing an employee, and to be able to protect them and their confidentiality.
239-1310 with Terry Curry, the prosecutor of Marion County. And a reminder, he cannot comment on any pending case, any case on appeal, any case that he may be working on. He ain't going to tell us about it anyway. 239-1310. So now, next Tuesday is July 1st.
Yes, sir.
A lot of new laws take effect July 1st. One of them is a complete overhaul, as I understand it, of the criminal code in the state of Indiana. So this would sort of be like the, I guess, the legal version of going from Indiana's regular academic standards to the new college and career ready, kind of like Common Core standards. How are you and your deputy prosecutors getting ready for this? Is this a massive change?
It's a pretty significant change, and I guess I'd go back to one of your original comments, and you're a really smart guy, so I'm sure you'll be able to quickly figure out the difference between A, B, C, and D felonies, and now level one to level six felonies, which is what we've gone to, is to six levels of felonies. It's a significant change. To answer your direct question, and we've literally been working on it for months. Clearly, the first version of the code revision occurred in the 2013 legislatures, and with effective date of July 1 of this year. So we've known for a year and a half that it was coming. And so as a consequence, you know, we've literally been working for months in terms of internal training, in terms of incorporating the new code into our computer processes. We've also been involved to a great degree in doing outreach training for police officers. Our strike team would be working with the narcotics detectives in terms of bringing them up to speed. We've worked with, not only with IMPD, but we've had training sessions with the other agencies here in town, like Speedway, Beech Grove. And
so now here's a dumb question. Mm-hmm. So on Monday night, if the police catch a bad guy at 11:58 p.m., doing something wrong, are they charged under the old law, or are they charged based upon when the paperwork is done after July 1st?
If any conduct occurs before, midnight in July 1, it would be governed by the old code. Mm-hmm. We successfully completed a cold case homicide that occurred in 1977, which had, I honestly don't even remember the classification or the characterization at the time, but it was like a separate right. degree of murder, like mm-hmm. a second degree murder or something like that. And so the statute in effect at the time of the conduct is what's going to apply.
The other thing is there are some changes in the new criminal code where some lesser or nonviolent penalties could result in community corrections as opposed to somebody getting locked up in the state correctional institution. Is this something the community needs to be aware of, that maybe down the road they hear about some crime and they think, aha, this is a crime where somebody will be locked up, and then they find out, no, under the new rules, it would be a community corrections type thing?
Right. The whole intent of, I don't say the entire intent, but one of the driving considerations in the legislature was to reduce the population of DOC, and their goal is to create a situation where more individuals are going into community corrections or perhaps serve whatever sentence they have at county level as opposed to the DOC, as well as to have more individuals be on probation as opposed to being incarcerated. Now, correspondingly, the belief all along was that by doing this, that the savings at the state level of the DOC is supposed to flow down to the county to fund, as you said, community corrections, increased probation. And I can tell you from our perspective, we're a little apprehensive as to whether that's going to occur or not.
Are you having a concern that there may be a budgetary impact going into next year's extremely tight city-county budget, that we've got to find the money for community corrections, if particularly in some drug cases where, depending upon the offense, it's now going to be a community corrections type offense as opposed to sending somebody to Pendleton or something.
There's absolutely concern that that will be the case. I mean, I don't think there's any question that if the code ends up being effectuated in the way that it's intended, that it's going to have an increased burden at the county level in terms of community corrections, in terms of individuals at low-level felonies serving short sentences in county jail as opposed to DOC. There's no doubt it'll have an impact.
Supreme Court this morning ruled and unanimously, and I think the unanimity was a surprise to some, on this case involving a couple of cell phone cases where the court said in very colloquial language that if an arrest is made and the suspect has a cell phone, there needs to be a warrant before law enforcement can search the contents of that phone. Is that going to be something? Because I'm sure the way society is now, just about everybody the police arrest is carrying a cell phone. Is that going to be something where there's got to be a quick meeting of the minds between law enforcement and prosecutor to make sure that law enforcement does things correctly based upon the court's order?
Right. And clearly, you know, just like in any other area, just I was talking about in terms of the new criminal code, you know, we're constantly communicating with, you know, whatever particular division of the department, any division of our office working with, we're communicating changes in the law. You know, but having said that, our approach has always been, and I think the department's is, you know, in an abundance of caution, you know, in any given circumstance, you know, we'll take the time to get a warrant. And, you know, in the setting of an arrest in particular, there still would be no reason why an officer could not take possession of anything that was on the person of the individual arrested. Now, in terms of cell phone, then there's the additional step. You couldn't, you know, then start perusing through it based on that ruling. But nevertheless, if you had probable cause to believe that there was something on that phone that would justify looking at it, it would be a very simple thing then to make the request for a warrant and obtain the search warrant to do that.
Is this the same as in a briefcase? In other words, if law enforcement arrests a bad guy and there's a briefcase in the car, you still would have to get a warrant to be able to look at and have probable cause as to why you need to look into the briefcase.
Yeah, absent consent. Yes, that would be the case. That's true.
You guys were investigating whatever happened with leasing part of the old Eastgate Shopping Center for this rock that was supposed to be this beautiful, wonderful operation center. And when I look on the outside, there are places in Beirut that look better on the outside than that place. The Ballard administration was holding on to documents tighter than Richard Nixon ever did. And you were doing a criminal investigation, but you found nothing that violated state law?
I don't feel comfortable going into any great detail in terms of what the investigators looked at and what they reported to our office. But, you know, the background was that, as you well know, there were all these rumors and suggestions of things that might or might have been done wrong in terms of the original execution of the lease and the performance of the lease. And so we felt it was appropriate to investigate or have someone look at that, and in addition, felt that it was appropriate to have an independent agency look at it as opposed to IMPD, since obviously they're intimately involved. And so we explicitly requested the state police to assign investigators. They did so. That request was made in December, and what I can say is they reviewed a number of documents, interviewed a number of individuals, and based upon that, reached the conclusion that they did not believe there had been any criminal conduct.
So if you're not looking into this and you're done with it and you're moving on to other things, from your point of view, is there any reason why the Ballard administration cannot today, tomorrow, or just in time for the 4th of July weekend, release all of the documents that they have been holding up and let's get this thing over with?
Well, I obviously don't have any direct involvement in that dispute. I'm sure my friend Joe Simpson will continue to push the issue until there's a resolution. And so You know, I don't know the basis for that. But as I also said in talking about, you know, from our perspective, you know, our sole purpose was to determine whether there was any criminal conduct. You know, we're not here to pass judgment whether it was a bad deal, you know, whether corners were cut, and, you know, that's for someone else to decide.
So here we are, and it's about budget time. How did the budget process work so far this year, and are you dreading the 2015 budget because it was all kind of fighting and arguing and carrying on?
And from our standpoint, the budget process has not really started in earnest yet. I mean, clearly, you know, we're doing our own internal work. We just received notice that our first presentation will be at the end of August. I mean, this has been a difficult process. We've gotten hammered every year in terms of our budget, and we want to be good stewards of the public dollar just like any other elected official, but it's a difficult process. So, you know, we want to provide the range of services that we currently have, and so, you know, we have to be imaginative in how we continue to fund our entire office and still provide the service we think we need to do.
Has your caseload been higher this year so far?
No, not particularly. Okay. I mean, it's been pretty steady, about the same. I mean, clearly, from all of the coverage that there's been, understandably, of the violent crime that's occurred, the public perception would be that there's you know, a crime wave as such. But in terms of just the overall crime and the volume of work in our office, it's relatively steady.
See, the things that we learn on this. See, Chris would have thought that it would have been, you know, all this crime and things are higher. See the things that we're learning. That's why we're having on the program.
Glad to help.
Now I got to ask you. I hear you are running for re-election.
That would be true.
Why? Why you want to do this for another 4 years?
As you probably recall, when I became a candidate in 2009, and what ultimately is the 2010 election. I did so because a number of individuals approached me and asked me if I would do it. And having worked as a deputy prosecutor for 6 years, obviously I knew what the office was like. Mm-hmm. You know, I knew the work that goes on and the character of the people that work there. But in all honesty, having taken office, it's been much more pleasurable than I ever imagined. I mean, I tell people this all the time, and I'm sure they think I'm just, you know, a BS politician, but, you know, I get to come into an office every day where there's almost 400 people who love what they do, enjoy what they do, they're passionate about what they do, and it's just a great atmosphere to work in. And, you know, in spite of the fact that, you know, we deal with human tragedy, you know, there are things that go on in our office every single day that we can feel good about. And so, absolutely. This is the greatest job I could ever have. I'd like to do it 4 more years.
So now if there are people listening that want to find out about the campaign side of Terry Curry, you know, how do they get a hold of you on the campaign side?
Obviously, we have a website, terrycurry.com. So there's all kinds of contact information. And I don't recall off the top of my head, AJ perhaps can nod his head. I can't remember if it's info@terrycurry or contact@terrycurry.com email. info@terrycurry.com.
See, and he's so focused on doing the job that that somebody had to give him the note and remind him with the email. info@terrycurry.com.
Right.
terrycurry.com.
We will follow up.
Terry Curry, Marion County Prosecutor, always good to see you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.